Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, a scrapbook in sound, Dublin, 1932, and theology on the agenda at the 50th International Eucharistic Congress, about to take place once again in this same city. But first, a musical meditation to mark the feast of Corpus Christi. Let's begin then by joining Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
At the Brigittine Convent in Rome, the design on the tabernacle door shows a pelican feeding its young. With its long beak, the pelican bites its breast, releasing drops of blood to feed the young. That image has captured the imaginations of writers and artists over the centuries, from ancient Egypt right through to the present. Shakespeare and Dante both used it. And so did St. Thomas Aquinas in a hymn he wrote about the great gift of the Eucharist, when Christ feeds us with his own body and blood. The feast of Corpus Christi was established during St. Thomas's lifetime. He probably wrote many of the prayers we use in the liturgy on this feast. And he also wrote some fine hymns in honour of the Blessed Sacrament. Not only Adoro Te, that we just heard, but also O Salutaris Ostia and Tantum Ergo, that we sing at benediction. The Church's teaching on the Eucharist is explored thoroughly in St. Thomas's theological writings, but the heart of it is expressed beautifully and simply in his Eucharistic hymns. O Thou, our reminder of Christ crucified, living bread, the life of us for whom he died, lend this life to me then, feed and feast my mind. There be thou the sweetness man was meant to find. St. Thomas develops the idea of the pelican feeding its young with its own blood. One drop of our Lord's precious blood, he says, is enough to redeem the world. So you often see a pelican used in Christian art as a symbol for the Eucharist. Corpus Christi College in Oxford, founded just before the Reformation, has a pelican proudly perched on top of the column in the front quadrangle. Now, I don't know whether any of you have ever tried translating Latin hymns into English. It isn't easy. And if you want to try and use the same plainsong tune for the English version, you really need to be a genius. Fortunately, a genius was at hand to translate St. Thomas's Adoro Te in the person of the Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins. Another skillful translator of Latin hymns was Edward Caswall, a priest who entered the Birmingham Oratory shortly after it was founded by John Henry Newman in the mid-19th century. Father Caswall's name crops up everywhere in Catholic hymn books, mainly for his translations, but also for some texts of his own, like See Amid the Winter's Snow and O Jesus Christ Remember. Let's listen now to his translation of St. Thomas's Adoro Te. O Godhead hid, devoutly I adore thee.
Thank you.
That tune is called Aquinas, appropriately enough, and it was written by Sir Richard Terry, First Master of Music at Westminster Cathedral. The cathedral is dedicated to the Most Precious Blood, and as you enter the Blessed Sacrament Chapel there, you see a lovely bronze pelican lovingly shedding its blood. As we celebrate the Feast of Corpus Christi, we could use this hymn to help us in our prayer. The words of St. Thomas, translated by Gerard Manley Hopkins or by Edward Caswell, offer us plenty of food for thought and food for prayer.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whittemore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Now, as mentioned a moment ago, let's shine the spotlight on this 50th International Eucharistic Congress about to take place in Dublin from the 10th to the 17th of June. I'd like to do this by bringing you a scrapbook in sound, stepping back in time. The first Eucharistic Congress to be held in Dublin took place in June of 1932. It was to be an event so moving it would live on in the hearts and minds of Irish Catholics for generations to come. A moment described at the time in the media as a great Catholic festival with scenes of ecstatic religious fervour. On one occasion, Paramount News reported how in the festooned streets decorated with white flowers, the faithful knelt in adoration. As a solemn 4-mile procession, with the consecrated host carried high for all to see, wound its way to the sacramental pavilion at O'Connell Bridge. 80 years on, in his basic text on the forthcoming Dublin Eucharistic Congress, scheduled once again in this city in the month of June, from the 10th to the 17th, the current Archbishop of Dublin, Dermot Martin, places this 1932 Congress into an historical context, explaining how it marked a moment of great religious accomplishment. Quote, "The event responded to the needs of piety which people felt at that moment. It responded to the need for affirmation of the Catholic community in Ireland, finding its way in the newly independent state. Today, Irish society has changed, and Irish piety has changed. People are hesitant about a sense of triumph in the public affirmation of their faith." Unquote. Archbishop Martin then highlights in this basic text how coming after the Civil War, which radically divided the people of Ireland, this Eucharistic Congress represented the first major national event which brought together both sides, thus pointing to how, at a national level, the event represented a strong moment of reconciliation. But why don't we step back in time for a moment to 1932? In those days, popes just didn't travel. They sent a representative to attend major events such as this one. And the Pope of the time, Pius XI, did exactly that. His choice fell on a cardinal of great distinction both at home and abroad, his name Lorenzo Lauri. It was to him that the Pope entrusted this message.
"Go to Ireland in my name, and say to the good people assembled there that the Holy Father loves Ireland and its inhabitants and visitors, and imparts not the usual apostolic blessing, but a very special, all-embracing one."
Why don't we listen for a moment to a rare archive recording of the time, taken from National Irish Radio, ORTE, which includes some rather crackly sound of Cardinal Lowry himself, introduced first by the reporter, who points to this historical moment.
The first papal legate to visit Ireland for four centuries lands at Kingstown. Greeted on arrival by the Archbishop of Dublin and President de Valera, the papal legate, Cardinal Lorenzo Lauri, is accompanied by them on his triumphal journey to the city. No sign of a royal house ever received such a welcome as is accorded this Prince of the Church, and scenes of unparalleled religious fervour mark every mile of his journey into the city.
In your eminence, we gladly recognize the living image of the Church, which is one because of the supreme authority of the successor of St. Peter.
Do not wish to leave Ireland without giving myself the pleasure of speaking to you, to greet you in the name of the Holy Father and to bestow on you his blessing.
And the visitors Pius the 11th referred to did come to Dublin, thousands of them from across the world, priests, nuns and lay faithful. Perhaps too because many of these pilgrims were of Irish stock, and the Congress coincided with the 1,500th anniversary of St. Patrick's arrival on the Emerald Isle. What's certain is that reports of the time described how for 6 days Dublin became, in a sense, the hub of the Catholic world. Down at the port, a dozen or so ocean liners had moored, and pilgrims had poured out down the gangplanks. From all the continents they came, from Europe, of course, but also from further away. The United States and Canada, Latin America, Australia, some even came from China. Many of them had come to know Ireland through the Irish missionary presence in their home country. Let's recall, too, the importance Pius XI attributed to missionary zeal. Just listen to him speaking in Italian, in praise of missionary zeal, in a rather crackly radio message of that same year.
La figura del missionario cattolico irradia dei fulgidi splendori dell'eroismo. Eroe nel quotidiano.
You may be wondering how Dublin dealt with the arrival of these pilgrims. It seems from records of the time that it proved to be a welcoming city, for while many found lodgings in the liners acting as floating hotels, others were invited into the homes of Dubliners. There had even been mattress handouts on the part of the authorities. So extraordinary was the event that the government had passed a special act for the occasion. And on a more flashy note, local authorities had arranged for all the major buildings to be lit up at night by a series of powerful spotlights and coloured lamps. The highlight of this momentous occasion came on the final day of the Congress, as an estimated million faithful gathered for an open-air Holy Mass in the 15-acre Phoenix Park, and the Pope, from Rome, lent his voice to the occasion, from the Vatican's Apostolic Library, through the microphones of Vatican Radio, for all to hear right across Dublin, through loudspeakers set up across the city. All could hear the announcer pronouncing these words in Latin, Attendite Beatissimus Pater, statim loquetur vobis. And all knelt as they understood the Holy Father's words were about to reach them. They expressed hope. We pray, he said, that God may grant you the gifts of unity and peace. Imparting his apostolic blessing over, he said, your our beloved Ireland, and rest there forever. The atmosphere was described as quiet and prayerful. Many among the faithful donned badges, the smartest of which were manufactured in die-stamped brass with gilt coating and blue enamel, the text reading Internat Dublinensis Congresso Eucharistic. No doubt many Irish still treasure these in their homes today. Among the many visitors present on this occasion was English Catholic writer G.K. Chesterton, who wrote at the time.
I confess I was myself enough of an outsider to feel flash through my mind as the illimitable multitude began to melt away towards the gates and roads and bridges, the instantaneous thought, this is democracy, and everyone is saying there is no such thing.
Little did Chesterton know that many years later, the first and only Pope ever to visit Ireland, the now blessed John Paul II, would stand tall in this very same park and preside over Holy Mass in this very same spot, stressing that spiritual union between generations in Ireland, who have, he said, done God's will through the ages up to the present day.
We are one in faith and spirit with the vast throng which filled this Phoenix Park on the occasion of the last great Eucharistic hosting held on this spot at the Eucharistic Congress in 1932.
And to get the feel of a time once again, let's listen to some more from the archive recording we heard a moment ago.
Over 20,000 priests take part in this moving pageant of the Sacred Host, and the pilgrims, in a column 15 miles long, 8 abreast, have marched down from Phoenix Park, converging around the high altar on O'Connell Bridge.
Now looking ahead to the forthcoming 2012 June Eucharistic Congress, I'd like to quote once again from the Archbishop of Dublin, Dermot Martin's basic text of the Dublin Eucharistic Congress. The passage therein, where he points as to how it too takes place at another crucial moment in the history of Ireland and of the Irish Church. Quote, "The Irish Church is in many ways a wounded church, and a church which seeks a new direction. Like many European countries, Ireland has undergone rapid social change in these years. Ireland has become a highly secularized society." Unquote. And again, further on in this text, touching on the recent scandal of sexual abuse of children by priests and religious in Ireland, Archbishop Martin says, quote, "This scandal has damaged the faith of many who feel robbed of their faith and feel betrayed by their church. This is so also of many of those who were abused and feel that a spiritual renewal should be an essential part of the healing process." Unquote. Finally, last but not least, we join Emma McCarthy, who brings us an interview with a professor of systematic theology from Maynooth Seminary in Ireland, who's also chairperson of the symposium organising committee. He's Father Brendan Leahy.
It is a happy coincidence of two events. It's the 50th anniversary of the Congress, but it's also the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council. And Archbishop Dermot Martin, from the very beginning, has linked those two very strongly together. And given the ecclesiology of communion has often been declared the ecclesiology, the vision of the Church at the Second Vatican Council, we decided that we would make that theme the topic for consideration at the Congress, at the symposium. So it will actually be the ecclesiology of communion 50 years after the opening of the Second Vatican Council.
We saw a major turnaround in the theology of the Eucharist in the 1960 Eucharistic Congress in Munich. There really was a radical change in the entire body of work that came out as a result of that on the theology of the Eucharist.
Well, I suppose it's true to say that, you know, 1960s, 70s, probably there were new insights very much linked to the time of the Council, linked to the more social aspects of the Eucharist. And they were discovered in those years, and there was a certain excitement, I suppose, in those years. Nevertheless, I suppose we could hope that in our time, too, there will be a greater rediscovery of the Eucharist, because the theme of communion has yet not been sufficiently explored. We know it notionally, and we agree that that is way forward, but we really haven't completely explored what is the logic of communion, how does it work, and how does it work at every level of the church's life. Well, here, you know, the Eucharist does have the genetic code, and if we allow ourselves come and really immerse ourselves in the mystery of the Eucharist, we will discover a genetic code as to how it is we then are to live with one another in our exchanges, in our working together, and that is something we still have a long way to go. For instance, we have started, of course, with pastoral councils and working together, but sometimes they've come a cropper because people have just felt not quite sure how to live those realities. The risk is they can become just structures, and structures themselves will never change the world, although they're always necessary. Structural change is always necessary. But you need the heart, the spirit, what John Paul II called the spirituality of communion. And I think it's that direction we may have to move along a bit more. Learn from the Eucharist a spirituality that is practical of how to live communion with one another in the life of the church at all levels, but then in our outreach to others as well. And so perhaps we're needing a more integrated moment where social dimension, the mystery dimension, the devotional dimension, the cosmic dimension, that's another dimension, of course, coming out today, ecology, etc., that these things can be brought together into a kind of a spirituality of the Eucharist to be lived out among Catholics in their everyday life of the Church.
One of the greatest threats, perhaps, to the Eucharist, if we can call it a threat, but it is something that Pope Benedict XVI, something he has often spoken about, is the fact that the people of God seem to be turning away from the Eucharist and from the weekly celebration of the Eucharist. They're no longer keeping Sunday as the holy day. Is this a theme that you perhaps might speak about?
Well, clearly such a day-to-day theme will very much be of interest to us, naturally. For instance, Professor Martin Stuflesser of Würzburg, he's a liturgist, he will be reflecting on some of that in terms of the actual developments of liturgy in recent years, whereas Professor Joris Geldof from Louvain is talking specifically about the challenge of secularization to our whole tradition of the Mass for many people. As you say, many people today no longer, in the Western world especially, practicing their faith in a regular form. But, for instance, Professor Geldof, I think, will bring out the whole point that, you know, on the other hand, secularization is the environment in which we're living today. Of course, we can lament it, but at the same time, we've also to see behind it something of some sign of the times from the point of view of God's plan unfolding, and perhaps it's putting it up to us to make sure that the liturgy itself and our living out of the Mass, the Eucharist, radiates a joy that is attractive so that others will discover a reason to frequent and assist and go to Mass more regularly. And I think it'll be points like that that we'll be reflecting on. What is it that those of us who believe in the centrality of the Eucharist, what is it that we really appreciate about the Eucharist that we need to perhaps focus more on so as to be able to radiate to others, yes, this is something worth coming to, this is attractive, this is something that gives meaning to life. Especially in a secularized culture where very often there's a collapse of meaning or a collapse of the smaller projects of life, people looking around, especially now with economic downturn, people looking around for new forms of community, people looking around for new ways of being together. We, in our own tradition in the Catholic Church, huge resource that perhaps we need to explore more directly in terms of what does Eucharistic celebration have to say to a contemporary world. So I think, yes, that will be a focus.
But there is something very specific in the Irish Catholic psyche regarding Mass and the celebration of the Eucharist. How would you explain that to people who are not Irish about the devotion that has always been specific with Irish Catholics to the Eucharist?
You are correct. I mean, one of the interesting things is that one of the earliest Latin hymns or the Eucharist is actually Irish. It comes from Ireland. So there is no doubt about it that right back in our tradition we have texts, poems, references to Eucharist. So that it is a very deep-rooted tradition. Of course, it is always worth keeping in mind that Irish Christianity goes back to the 5th century and continues unbroken to today. And in that sense, we are a country with very, very deep roots. And even if today that may be challenged in all kinds of ways, the roots are very deep. So I think Irish people have been through different regimes, monasteries and the invasion of the Vikings and the Normans and with the Reformation. But throughout all of that, they have remained constant in their appreciation and heartfelt thanksgiving, I think, for the gift of the Eucharist. And I think having sustained many different pressures over many different centuries, it is, as you say, very deep in the Irish psyche. Mass is the place where I think they find themselves relating to the Trinity, where creation, as it were, finds its ability to say thanks to God, and creation is very strong in the Irish psyche. We have also a great sense of the presence of Mary, which in a certain sense is, feeds into an Irish sense of you participate at the Eucharist in a certain sense, reflecting Mary's yes in your life to God. And so there is very warm, heartfelt sense that the Eucharist is a point of deep contact with God.
The healing power of the Eucharist. This is very important to Ireland today, where we have seen a past century that was not only marked by internal conflict, but also with the internal wounds that were created by the abuse scandal within the church. Will this Congress also represent an opportunity for healing between Irish people, between the church and Irish people also?
Yes, well, certainly historically, 1932, the Eucharistic Congress then was a healing moment because it came just after a very bitter civil war where brothers were no longer speaking, and the Congress became a moment of healing that has been recognized. We're at a different moment today. We've also had some very, very dark moments, and unfortunately also in the life of the church itself, we've had very dark moments of abuse, and that has left very deep wounds of the immediate victims involved, but I suppose also deep wounds beyond the immediate victims, to those who are indirect victims, those whose religious sense has been severely offended by what has gone on, the tremendous disappointment in failures in leadership in the life of the church. So that is a wound that is very deep. For those who are immediate victims of abuse, perhaps they will find it very difficult to darken the door of our Congress. Some might, and I hope and pray they do, and hope and pray that they will find something of the healing. Some sessions are dedicated specifically to the topic of healing, as indeed in our own symposium. But there are many others whose wound, is more indirect, and who may come along to the symposium and to the Congress. I do hope that something of the atmosphere and something of the range of church life that would be put before them, they might find a glimmer of hope, of belief, of rediscovery of faith in their life that goes beyond the immediate failures of any particular church leader or representative, but rather they might see that there is people who believe and people who have faith and try to love day by day in their lives, that might be a healing for them. I think above all, we could say that if the symposium and Congress help us ourselves to work more together in these days, that in itself brings healing, because way healing, reconciliation is always going to be the fruit of unity, communion. Paradoxically, the unity, the communion comes first and then the healing comes second. Sometimes we think it's the other way around, but really if we are more united in our working together during this symposium, I think healing will be a beneficial effect for others.
And warm thanks there go to Father Brendan Leahy and, of course, to Emma McCarthy for bringing us this interview. She'll be reporting for us from Dublin in the next week. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.